He rubbed the bridge of his nose with a knuckle.
Maybe you weren't jealous. I am.
He hesitated.
I'd tell you, though, how it was, if you wanted to know.
I looked at him, biting my lip dubiously.
Did I want to know? If I didn't, and I wasn't at all sure whether I did or not, would he take that as evidence that I didn't care?
And I was quite conscious of that brief.
I am.
I took a deep breath, accepting the implied bargain. Tell me, I said, how it was. Now he did look away, and I saw his throat move as he swallowed.
It was tender, he said quietly after a moment. Sad.
Sad? I echoed. How? He didn't look up, but kept his eyes fixed on the flowers, following the movements of a big black bumblebee among the furled blooms.
Both of us mourning things that were lost, he said slowly, brows drawn down in thought. She said she meant to keep me alive for me, to let me imagine it was you, I suppose she meant.
Didn't work quite that way?
No.
He looked up then, straight on, and his eyes went through me like a rapier through a scarecrow.
There couldn't have been anyone like you.
It wasn't said with an air of compliment, more one of flat finality,
or even of resentment.
I lifted a shoulder briefly.
There wasn't much response I could make.
And? He sighed and looked back at his knotted hands. He was squeezing the fingers of his narrowed right hand with his left, as though to remind himself of the missing finger.
It was quiet, he said to his thumb. We didn't talk, really. Not once we'd begun.
He closed his eyes, and I wondered, with a small twinge of curiosity, just what he saw. I was surprised to realize that curiosity was all I felt, with, perhaps, pity for them. I'd seen the cave in which they'd made love, a cold granite tomb, and I knew how desperate the state of things had been in the Highlands then. Just the promise of a little human warmth.
Both of us mourning things that were lost, he'd said. It was just the once. It didn't last very long. It had been a long time,
he said, and a faint flush showed across his cheekbones.
But I needed it very much. She held me after, and I needed that more. I fell asleep in arms. She was gone when I woke. But I carried the warmth of her with me. For a long time, he said very softly.
That gave me a quite unexpected stab of jealousy, and I straightened a little, fighting it back with clenched hands. He sensed it and turned his head toward me. He'd felt that flame ignite, and had one to match it.
And you, he said,
giving me a hard, direct look. It wasn't tender, I said with an edge, and it wasn't sad. It should have been. When he came into my room and said he wouldn't mourn you alone, and we talked, then I got up and went to him, expecting, if I had so much as an expectation. I don't think I had any conscious thoughts.
No.
He matched my edge with his own.
Blind drunk, were you?
Yes, I bloody was. And so was he. I knew what he was thinking. He wasn't making any effort to hide it, and I had a sudden vivid recollection of sitting with him in the corner of a tavern in Cross Creek, his taking my face suddenly between his hands and kissing me, and the warm sweetness of wine passing from his mouth to mine. I sprang to my feet and slapped my hand on the bench. Yes, I bloody was, I said again, furious. I was drunk every damned day since I heard you were dead. He drew a deep, deep breath, and I saw his eyes fixed on his hands, clenched on his knees. He let it out very slowly.
And what did he give you then?
Something to hit, I said, at least to begin with. He looked up at me, startled.
You hit him?
No, I hit you, I snapped. My fist had curled without my realization, clenched against my thigh. I remembered that first blow, a blind, frenzied punch into unwary flesh, all the force of my grief behind it. The flex of recoil that took away the sensation of warmth for an instant brought it back with a smash that flung me onto the dressing table, borne down by a man's weight, his grip tight on my wrists and me screaming in fury. I didn't remember the specifics of what came next, or rather, I recalled certain things very vividly but had no idea of the order in which they happened. It was a blur, people say. What they really mean is the impossibility of anyone truly entering such an experience from outside. The futility of explanation. Mary McNab, I said abruptly. She gave you tenderness, you said. There should be a word for what this was, what John gave me. But I haven't thought of it yet. I needed a word that might convey, encapsulate. Violence, I said. That was part of it. Jamie stiffened and gave me a narrow look. I knew what he was thinking and shook my head. Not that. I was numb, deliberately numb, because I couldn't bear to feel. He could. He had more courage than I did. And he made me feel it too. That's why I hit him. I'd been numb, and John had ripped off the dressing of denial, the wrappings of the small daily necessities that kept me upright and functioning. His physical presence had torn away the bandages of grief and showed what lay below. Myself, bloody and unhealed. I felt the air thicken my throat, damp and hot and itching on my skin. And finally, I found the word. Triage, I said abruptly. Under the numbness, I was raw, bloody, skinned. You do triage, you stop the bleeding first. You stop it. You stop it, or the patient dies. He stopped it. He'd stopped it by slapping his own grief, his own fury, over the welling blood of mine. Two wounds pressed together, blood still flowing freely, but no longer lost and draining. Flowing instead into another body, and the other's blood into mine. Hot, searing, not welcome, but life. Jamie said something under his breath in Gaelic. I didn't catch most of the words. He sat with his head bent, elbows on his knees and head in his hands, and breathed audibly. After a moment, I sat back down beside him and breathed too. The cicadas grew louder, an urgent buzz that drowned out the rush of water and the rustling of leaves, humming in my bones. Damn him, Jamie muttered at last and sat up. He looked disturbed, angry, but not angry at me. John, is all right, isn't he? I asked hesitantly. To my surprise and my slight unease, Jamie's lips twisted a little.
Aye. Well, I'm sure he is, he said, in a tone admitting of a certain doubt which I found alarming.
What the bloody hell did you do to him? I said, sitting up straight. His lips compressed for an instant.
I hit him, he said. Twice, he added, glancing away.
Twice? I echoed in some shock. Did he fight you?
No, he said shortly.
Really? I rocked back a bit, looking him over. Now I had calmed down enough to take notice, I thought he was displaying... what? Concern? Guilt? Why did you hit him? I asked, striving for a tone of mild curiosity rather than one of accusation. Evidently I was less than successful with this, as he turned on me like a bear stung in the rump by a bee.
Why? You dare to ask me why?
Certainly I do, I said, discarding the mild tone. What did he do to make you hit him? And twice?
Jamie had no problem with mayhem, but he normally did require a reason.
He made a deeply disgruntled Scottish noise, but he'd promised me honesty a long time ago and hadn't seen fit to break that promise yet. He squared his shoulders and looked at me straight.
The first was between him and me. It was a blow I've owed him for a good while.
And you just seized the opportunity to punch him because it was convenient? I asked, a bit wary of asking directly what the devil he meant by between him and me.
I couldn't help it, he said testily. He said something, and I hit him.
I didn't say anything but inhaled through my nose, meaning him to hear it. There was a long moment of silence, weighted with expectation, and broken only by the shush of the river.
He said the two of you hadn't been making love to each other, he finally muttered, looking down.
No, we weren't, I said, somewhat surprised. I told you. We were both... Oh. He did look up at me then, glaring.
Oh,
he said, the word dripping with sarcasm.
You were both fucking me, he said.
Oh, I see, I murmured. Well, yes, that's quite true. I rubbed the bridge of my nose. I see, I said again, and thought I probably did. There was a deep friendship of long standing between Jamie and John, but I was aware that one of the pillars it rested on was a strict avoidance of any reference to John's sexual attraction toward Jamie. If John had lost his composure sufficiently as to kick that pillar out from under the two of them.
And the second time? I asked, choosing not to ask him to elaborate any further on the first.
Well, that one was on your account, he said, both voice and face relaxing a little. I'm flattered, I said, as dryly as possible.
But you really shouldn't have.
Well, I ken that now, he admitted, flushing. But I'd lost my temper already. I hadn't got it back again. Ethan, he muttered,
and stooping, picked up the discarded digging knife and jammed it hard into the bench beside him. He closed his eyes then, pressed his lips tight, and sat tapping the fingers of his right hand against his leg. He hadn't done that since I'd amputated the remains of his frozen fourth finger, and I was taken aback to see him do it now. For the first time, I began to appreciate the true complexities of the situation. "Tell me," I said, in a voice not much louder than the cicadas. "Tell me what you're thinking."
"About John Gray. About Hellwater."
He drew a deep, exasperated breath and opened his eyes, though he didn't look at me.
"I managed there, staying numb, as you said. I suppose I might have stayed drunk too had I been able to afford it."
His mouth twisted, and he folded his right hand into a fist, then looked down at it in surprise. He hadn't been able to do that for 30 years. He opened it and put his hand flat on his knee.
"I managed," he repeated. "But then there was Geneva. And I told you how that was too, did I not?"
"You did." He sighed.
"And then there was William. When Geneva died and it was my fault, it was a knife in my heart. And then... William."
His mouth softened.
"The bairn cut me wide open, Sassenach. He spilled my guts out into my hands."
I put my hand on his, and he turned it, his fingers curling over mine.
"And that bloody English sodomite bandaged me," he said, so low I could scarcely hear him above the sound of the river, "with his friendship."
He drew breath again and let it out explosively.
"No, I didna kill him. I dinna ken if I'm glad of it or not. But I didn't."
I let out my own breath in a deep sigh and leaned against him. I knew that. I'm glad. The haze had thickened into steel-grey clouds coming purposefully up the river, muttering with thunder. I took a deep, lung-filling whiff of ozone and then another of his skin. I detected the basic male animal, very appetizing in itself, but he seemed to have acquired a rather unusual, though savoury, bouquet in addition. A faint whiff of sausage, the strong, bitter scent of cabbage, and, yes, mustard, underlaid with something oddly spicy. I sniffed again, repressing the urge to lick him.
You smell like...
I smell like a large plate of choucroute garni, he interrupted with a slight grimace. Give me a moment. I'll have a wash.
He made as though to get up and go toward the river, and I reached out and seized him by the arm. He looked at me for a moment, then drew a deep breath, and reaching slowly out in turn, pulled me against him. I didn't resist. In fact, my own arms went round him in reflex, and we both sighed in unison, in the sheer relief of embrace. I would have been quite content to sit there forever, breathing the musky, dusty, cabbage-laced smell of him, and listening to the thump of his heart under my ear. All the things we'd said, all the things that had happened, hovered in the air around us like the cloud of troubles from Pandora's box. But for this one moment, there was nothing but each other. After a bit, his hand moved, smoothing the loose, damp curls behind my ear. He cleared his throat and shifted a little, drawing himself up, and I reluctantly let go of him, though I left my hand on his thigh.
I wish to see something, he said,
in the tone of one making a formal statement before a court. My heart had quieted while he held me. Now it fluttered in renewed agitation.
What?
I sounded so apprehensive that he laughed.
Only a breath, but he did laugh, and I was able to breathe again.
He took my hand firmly and held it, looking into my eyes.
I don't say that I dinna mind this, because I do. And I don't say that I'll no make a fuss about it later, because I likely will. But what I do say is that there is nothing in this world or the next that can take ye from me, or me from you.
He raised one brow.
Do you disagree?
Oh, no, I said fervently. He breathed again, and his shoulders came down a fraction of an inch.
Well, that's good, because it wouldn't do you any good if you did. Just the one question, he said. Are you my wife?
Of course I am, I said in utter astonishment. How could I not be? His face changed then. He drew a huge breath and took me into his arms. I embraced him hard, and together we let out a great sigh, settling with it, his head bending over mine, kissing my hair. My face turned into his shoulder, open mouthed at the neck of his open shirt, our knees slowly giving way in mutual relief, so that we knelt in the fresh-turned earth, clinging together, rooted like a tree, leaf-tossed and multi-limbed, but sharing one single, solid trunk. The first drops of rain began to fall. His face was open now, and his eyes clear blue and free of trouble, for the moment at least.
Where is there a bed? I need to be naked with you.
I was entirely in sympathy with this proposition, but the question took me momentarily aback. Of course we couldn't go to John's house, or at least not in order to go to bed together. Even if John himself was in no position to object, the thought of what Mrs. Fig would say if I walked into the house with a large Scotsman and immediately ascended the stairs to my bedroom with him. And then there was Jenny. On the other hand, eager as I was, I really didn't want to be naked with him among the ranunculars, where we might be interrupted at any moment by bathrooms, bumblebees, or rain.
An inn? I suggested.
Is there one where folk wouldna ken you? A decent one, I mean.
I knit my brows, trying to think of one.
Not the King's Arms, definitely not that. Otherwise,
I was familiar only with the two or three ordinaries where Masali bought ale or bread,
and people most assuredly knew me there as Lady John Grey. It wasn't that Jamie by himself needed to avoid notice any more, but his supposed death and my marriage to John had been the subject of a tremendous amount of public interest, by reason of its tragedy. For it to become widely known that the presumably deceased Colonel Fraser had suddenly reappeared from the dead to reclaim his wife would be a subject of conversation that would dwarf the withdrawal of the British army from the city. I had a quick flash of memory. Our wedding night, witnessed at close quarters by a crowd of raucously drunk Highland clansmen, and imagined a reprise of this experience with interested commentary by the ordinary's patrons. I glanced at the river, wondering whether, after all, a nice sheltering bush. But it was late in the afternoon, cloudy, and the gnats and mosquitoes were hanging in small carnivorous clouds of their own beneath the trees. Jamie swooped suddenly and swept me up in his arms. I'll find a place.
There was a wooden thump as he kicked open the door of the new potting shed, and suddenly we were in a light-streaked darkness smelling of sun-warmed boards, earth, water, damp clay, and plants.
What? Here?
It was abundantly clear that he wasn't seeking privacy for the purpose of further inquiry, discussion, or reproach. For that matter, my own question was largely rhetorical. He stood me on my feet, turned me about, and began undoing my laces. I could feel his breath on the bare skin of my neck, and the tiny hairs there shivered.
"Are you?"
I began, only to be interrupted by a terse hush. I hushed. I could hear then what he'd heard, the Bartrams in conversation with each other. They were some distance away, though, on the back porch of the house, I thought, screened from the river path by a thick hedge of English yew.
"I don't think they can hear us," I said,
though I lowered my voice.
"I've done wi' talking,"
he whispered, and, leaning forward, closed his teeth gently on the nape of my exposed neck.
"Hush," he said again, though mildly.
I hadn't actually said anything, and the sound I'd made was too high-pitched to draw the attention of anything save a passing bat. I exhaled strongly through my nose and heard him chuckle deep in his throat. My stays came loose, and cool air flooded through the damp muslin of my shift. He paused, one hand on the tapes of my petticoats, to reach round with the other, and gently lift one breast, heavy and free, thumb rubbing the nipple hard and round as a cherry stone. I made another sound, this one lower pitched. I thought vaguely how fortunate it was that he was left-handed, as that was the hand nimbly engaged undoing the tapes of my skirts. These fell in a swishing heap round my feet, and I had a sudden vision, as his hand left my breast and the shift whiffed up round my ears, of young Mr. Bartram suddenly realizing a dire need to pot up a batch of rosemary seedlings. The shock probably wouldn't kill him, but...
"May as well be hung for sheep as lambs," Jamie said,
having evidently divined my thought from the fact that I turned round and was shielding my more private bits in the manner of Botticelli's Venus.
"And I'll have you naked."
He grinned at me, whipped off his own dirt-streaked shirt — he'd thrown off his coat when he set me down — and yanked down his breeks without pausing to undo the flies. He was thin enough to make this possible. The breeches hung on his hip bones, barely staying up by themselves, and I saw the shadow of his ribs beneath his skin as he bent to shed his stockings. He straightened, and I put a hand on his chest. It was damp and warm, and the ruddy hairs prickled into goose flesh at my touch. I could smell the hot, eager scent of him, even over the agricultural fog of the shed and the lingering smell of cabbage.
"Not so fast," I whispered. He made a Scottish sound of interrogation, reaching for me, and I dug my fingers into the muscle of his breast. "I want a kiss first."
He put his mouth against my ear and both hands firmly on my bottom.
"Are ye in a position to make demands, do you think?" he whispered, tightening his grasp.
I caught the faint barb in that.
"Yes, I bloody am," I said, and adjusted my own grip somewhat lower.
He wouldn't be attracting any bats, I thought.
We were eyeball to eyeball, clasped and breathing each other's breath, close enough to see the smallest nuance of expression, even in the dimness. I saw the seriousness that underlay the laughter, and the doubt beneath the bravado.
"I am your wife," I whispered, my lips brushing his.
"I ken that,"
he said very softly, and kissed me. Softly. Then closed his eyes and brushed his lips across my face, not so much as kissing, as feeling the contours of cheekbone and brow, of jaw, and the tender skin below the ear, seeking to know me again past skin and breath, to know me to the blood and bone, to the heart that beat beneath. I made a small sound and tried to find his mouth with my own, pressing against him, bare bodies cool and damp, hair rasping sweetly, and the lovely firmness of him rolling between us. He wouldn't let me kiss him, though. His hand gripped the tail of my hair at the base of my neck, cupping my head, the other hand pursuing the same game of blind man's buff. There was a rattling thump. I had backed into a potting bench, setting a tray of tiny seedling pots to vibrating, the spicy leaves of sweet basil trembling in agitation. Jamie pushed the tray aside with one hand, then grasped me by the elbows and lifted me onto the bench.
"Now," he said, half breathless, "I must have you now."
He did, and I ceased caring whether there were splinters in the bench or not. I wrapped my legs round him and he laid me flat and leaned over me, hands braced on the bench, with a sound halfway between bliss and pain. He moved slowly in me, and I gasped. The rain had grown from a patter to a ringing din on the tin roof of the shed, covering any sounds I might make, and a good thing too, I thought dimly. The air had cooled, but was full of moisture. Our skins were slick, and heat sprang up where flesh touched flesh. He was slow, deliberate, and I arched my back, urging him. In response, he took me by the shoulders, bent lower, and kissed me lightly, barely moving.
"I willna do it," he whispered,
and held tight when I struggled against him, trying vainly to goad him into the violent response I wished, I needed.
"Won't do what?"
I was gasping.
"I will not punish you for it,"
he said, so softly I could barely hear him, close as he was.
"I'll not do that, do you hear?"
"I don't frigging want you to punish me, you bastard," I grunted with effort, my shoulder joints creaking as I tried to break free of his grasp. "I want you to. God, you know what I want."
"Aye, I do."
His hand left my shoulder and cupped beneath my buttock, touching the flesh of our joining, stretched and slippery. I made a small sound of surrender and my knees loosened. He pulled back, then came back into me strongly enough that I gave a small, high-pitched cry of relief.
"Ask me to your bed," he said, breathless, hands on my arms. "I shall come to you. For that matter, I shall come, whether you ask it or no. But remember, Sassenach, I am your man. I serve you as I will."
"Do," I said. "Please do. Jamie,
I want you so. He seized my ass in both hands, hard enough to leave bruises, and I arched up into him, grasping, hands sliding on his sweat-slick skin.
God, Claire, I need you.
Rain was roaring on the tin roof now, and lightning struck close by, blue-white and sharp with ozone. We rode it together, forked and light-blind, breathless, and the thunder rolled through our bones. Chapter 25.
Give me liberty.
And as the sun set on the third day since he had left his home, Lord John William Bertram Armstrong Grey found himself once more a free man, with a full belly, a swimming head, a badly mended musket, and severely chafed wrists, standing before the Reverend Peleg Woodsworth, right hand uplifted, reciting as prompted. I, Bertram Armstrong, swear to be true to the United States of America, and to serve them honestly and faithfully against all their enemies and opposers whatsoever, and to observe and obey the orders of the Continental Congress and the orders of the generals and officers set over me by them.
Bloody hell, he thought. What next?
Part 2.
Meanwhile, back at the ranch.
Chapter 26. A Step into the Dark. October the 30th, 1980. Craignadun. A blotch of sweat darkened the shirt between William Buckley's shoulder blades. The air was cool, but it was a steep climb to the top of Craignadun, and the thought of what awaited them at the top was enough to make anybody sweat.
"You haven't got to come,"
Roger said to Buckley's back.
"Get stuffed," his great-great-great-great-great-grandfather replied briefly.
Buck spoke absent-mindedly, though, all his attention, like Roger's, focused on the distant crest of the hill. Roger could hear the stones from here, a low, sullen buzz, like a hive of hostile bees. He felt the sound move, crawling under his skin, and scratched viciously at his elbow, as though he could root it out.
"You've got the stones, eh?"
Buck stopped, clinging one-handed to a birch sapling as he looked back over his shoulder.
"I have," Roger said shortly. "Do you want yours now?"
Buck shook his head and wiped shaggy fair hair off his brow with the back of his free hand.
"Time enough,"
he said, and began to climb again. Roger knew the diamonds were there. He knew Buck knew, too, but put a hand into his jacket pocket anyway. Two rough pieces of metal clinked together, the halves of an old brooch Brianna had cut apart with the poultry shears, each half with a scatter of tiny diamonds, barely more than chips. He hoped to God they'd be enough. If not... The day was only cool, but a bone-deep shudder ran through him. He'd done it twice. Three times if he counted the first attempt, the one that had almost killed him. It got worse each time. He'd thought he wouldn't make it the last time, coming back on Ocracook, mind and body shredding in that place that was neither place nor passage. It had only been the feel of Jem in his arms that made him hold on, come through. And it was only the need to find Jem now that would make him do it again. A hydroelectric tunnel under the Loch Erochty Dam. He must be getting near the end of the tunnel. Jem could tell by the way the air pushed back against his face. All he could see was the red light on the service train's dashboard. Did you call it a dashboard on a train, he wondered. He didn't want to stop, because that meant he'd have to get out of the train into the dark. But the train was running out of track, so there wasn't much else he could do. He pulled back a bit on the lever that made the train go, and it slowed down. More. Just a little more, and the lever clicked into a kind of slot,
and the train stopped with a small jerk that made him stumble and grab the edge of the cab. An electric train didn't make any engine noise, but the wheels rattled on the track, and the train made squeaks and clunks as it moved. When it stopped, the noise stopped too. It was really quiet. "Hey," he said out loud, because he didn't want to listen to his heart beating. The sound echoed, and he looked up, startled. Mam had said the tunnel was really high, more than 30 feet, but he'd forgotten that. The idea that there was a lot of empty space hanging over him that he couldn't see bothered him a lot. He swallowed and stepped out of the tiny engine, holding onto the frame with one hand. "Hey," he shouted at the invisible ceiling. "Are there any bats out there?"
Silence.
He'd been kind of hoping there were bats. He wasn't afraid of them. There were bats in the old broch, and he liked to sit and watch them come out to hunt in the summer evenings. But he was alone, except for the dark. His hands were sweating. He let go of the metal cab and scrubbed both hands on his jeans. Now he could hear himself breathing, too. "Crap," he whispered under his breath. That made him feel better, so he said it again. Maybe he ought to be praying instead, but he didn't feel like that, not yet. "There was a door," Mam said, "at the end of the tunnel. It led into the service chamber where the big turbines could be lifted up from the dam if they needed fixing." Would the door be locked? Suddenly he realized that he'd stepped away from the train, and he didn't know whether he was facing the end of the tunnel or back the way he'd come. In a panic, he blundered to and fro, hands out, looking for the train. He tripped over part of the track and fell, sprawling. He lay there for a second, saying, "Crap, crap, 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 crap," because he'd skinned both knees and the palm of his hand. But he was okay, really. And now he knew where the track was, so he could follow it and not get lost. He got up, wiped his nose, and shuffled slowly along, kicking the track every few steps to be sure he stayed with it. He thought he was in front of where the train had stopped, so it didn't really matter which way he was going. Either he'd find the train, or he'd find the end of the tunnel. And then the door. If it was locked, maybe... Something like an electric shock ran right through him. He gasped and fell over backward. The only thing in his mind was the idea that somebody had hit him with a lightsaber like Luke Skywalker's, and for a minute he thought maybe whoever it was had cut off his head. He couldn't feel his body, but he could see in his mind his body lying bleeding in the dark, and his head sitting right there on the train tracks in the dark. And his head couldn't see his body, or even know it wasn't attached anymore. He made a breathless kind of a noise that was trying to be a scream, but it made his stomach move, and he felt that. He felt it. And suddenly he felt a lot more like praying. "Dio gracias," he managed to gasp. It was what Grandad said when he talked about a fight, or killing something. And this wasn't quite that sort of thing, but it seemed like a good thing to say anyway. Now he could feel all of himself again, but he sat up and grabbed his neck just to be sure his head was still on. His skin was jumping in the weirdest way, like a horse's does when a horsefly bites it, but all over. He swallowed and tasted sugared silver, and he gasped again, because now he knew what had hit him. Sort of. This wasn't quite like what it had been when they'd all walked into the rocks on Ocracoke. One minute he'd been in his father's arms, and the next minute it was as if he'd been scattered everywhere in little wiggly pieces like the spilled quicksilver in Granny's surgery. Then he was back together again, and Da was still holding him tight enough to squeeze his breath out, and he could hear Da sobbing, and that scared him, and he had a funny taste in his mouth. And little pieces of him were still wiggling around, trying to get away, but they were trapped inside his skin. Yeah, that was what was making his skin jump now. And he breathed easier, knowing what it was. That was okay then. He was okay. It would stop. It was stopping already, the twitchy feeling going away. He still felt kind of shaky, but he stood up. Careful, because he didn't know where it was. Wait, he did know. He knew exactly. "That's weird," he said out loud without really noticing, because he wasn't scared by the dark anymore. It wasn't important. He couldn't see it. Not with his eyes, not exactly. He squinted, trying to think how he was seeing it. But there wasn't a word for what he was doing. Kind of like hearing or smelling or touching, but not really any of those. But he knew where it was. It was right there, a kind of shiver in the air. And when he stared at it, he had a feeling in the back of his mind like pretty sparkly things, like sun on the sea, and the way a candle flame looked when it shone through a ruby. But he knew he wasn't really seeing anything like that. It went all the way across the tunnel, and up to the high roof, too, he could tell. But it wasn't thick at all. It was thin as air. He guessed that was why it hadn't swallowed him like the thing in the rocks on Ocracoke had. At least, he thought it hadn't, and for an instant worried that maybe he'd gone sometime else. But he didn't think so. The tunnel felt just the same, and so did he, now that his skin had stopped jumping. When they'd done it on Ocracoke, he'd known right away it was different. He stood there for a minute, just looking and thinking, and then shook his head and turned around, feeling with his foot for the track. He wasn't going back through that, no matter what. He'd just have to hope the door wasn't locked. The Laird's Study, Lallybroch Estate. Brianna's hand closed on the letter opener, but even as she calculated the distance involved, the obstacle of the desk between Rob Cameron and herself, and the flimsiness of the wooden blade, she was reluctantly concluding that she couldn't kill the bastard. Not yet. Where's my son?
He's okay.
She stood up suddenly and he jerked a little in reflex. His face flushed and he hardened his expression. He'd bloody well better be okay, she snapped. I said, where is he?
Oh, no, hen, he said, rocking back on his heels, affecting nonchalance. That's no how we're playing it. Not tonight.
God, why didn't Roger keep a hammer or a chisel or something useful in his desk drawer? Did he expect her to staple this jerk? She braced herself, both hands flat on the desk, to keep from leaping over it and going for his throat. I'm not playing, she said, through her teeth, and neither are you. Where's Jimmy? He levelled a long finger at her.
You're no longer the boss lady, Ms. Mackenzie. I call the shots now.
Oh, you think so, do you? She asked, as mildly as she could. Her thoughts were slipping past like grains of sand in an hourglass, a slithering cascade of what if, how, shall I? No, yes.
I do, I.
His colour, already high, rose higher, and he licked his lips.
You're going to find out what it's like to be on the bottom, hen.
Cameron's eyes were very bright, and his hair was clipped so short that she could see beads of sweat glittering above his ears. Was he high on something? She thought not. He was wearing track pants, and his fingers flicked unconsciously across the front, where a substantial bulge was beginning to show. Her lips tightened at the sight.
Not on your life, buddy.
She widened her gaze as much as possible to take him in without letting his eyes move from hers. She didn't think he was armed, though the pockets of his jackets had stuff in them. He really thought he could make her have sex with him without a set of manacles and a sledgehammer. He twirled his finger, pointing to the floor in front of him.
Come round here, hen, he said softly, and take your jeans down. Might do you good to learn what it's like to take it up the arse regularly. You've done it to me for months. Fair's fair, isn't it?
Very slowly she came round the desk, but stopped well short of him, keeping out of reach. She fumbled cold-fingered at the button of her fly, unwilling to look down, unwilling to take her eyes off him. Her heart was beating so hard in her ears that she could barely hear his heavy breathing. The tip of his tongue showed briefly, involuntarily, as she pushed the jeans down over her hips. And he swallowed.
"The knickers, too," he said, half breathless. "Take them off."
"You don't rape people very often, do you?" she said rudely, stepping out of the puddled jeans. "What's your rush?" She bent and picked the heavy denim pants up, shook out the legs, and turned as though to lay them on the desk, then whipped back, clutching the jeans at the ankle, and lashed them as hard as she could at his head. The heavy cloth, with its zipper and brass fly button, struck him full in the face, and he staggered back with a grunt of surprise, clutching at the jeans. She let go of them instantly, leapt onto the desk, and launched herself at him, shoulder first. They fell together with a crash that shook the hardwood floor, but she landed on top, kneed him hard in the belly, and then grabbed him by both ears and thumped his head on the floor as hard as she could. He let out a cry of pain, reached for her wrists, and she promptly let go of his ears, leaned backward, and grabbed for his crotch. Had she been able to get a decent grip on his balls through the soft fabric, she would have crushed them. As it was, she managed a glancing squeeze, but one hard enough to make him yelp and convulse, nearly dislodging her from her perch. She couldn't win a fist fight, couldn't let him hit her. She scrambled to her feet, looking wildly round the office for something heavy to hit him with, seized the wooden letterbox, and smashed it over his head as he started to rise. He didn't fall down, but bobbed his head, dazed amongst the cascade of letters, and she kicked him in the jaw as hard as she could, her own teeth clenched. It was a sliding, sweaty impact, but she'd hurt him. She'd hurt herself, too, had kicked him with her heel as much as she could, but she felt a burst of pain in the middle of her foot. She'd torn or broken something, but it didn't matter. Cameron shook his head violently, trying to clear it. He was on his hands and knees now, crawling toward her, reaching for her leg, and she backed up against the desk. With a banshee shriek, she kneed him in the face, squirmed out of his grasp, and ran for the hall, limping heavily. There were weapons on the walls of the foyer, a few chargers and broadswords kept for ornament, but all hung high, to be out of the children's reach. There was a better one easily to hand, though. She reached behind the coat rack and grabbed Jem's cricket bat. "You can't kill him," she kept thinking, dimly surprised at the fact that her mind was still working. "Don't kill him. Not yet. Not till he says where Jemmy is." "Fucking bitch!" He was nearly on her, panting, half blinded by blood running down his forehead, half sobbing through the blood pouring from his nose. "Fuck you. Split you open. Fuck you up the..." "Cashaldoon!" she bellowed, and stepping out from behind the coat rack, swung the bat in a scything arc that caught him in the ribs. He made a gurgling noise and folded, arms across his middle. She took a deep breath, swung the bat as high as she could, and brought it down with all her strength on the crown of his head. The shock of it vibrated up her arms to her shoulders, and she dropped the bat with a clunk, and stood there, gasping, trembling, and drenched with sweat.
"Mummy," said a tiny, quavering voice from the foot of the stairs. "Why is you not got pants on, Mummy?"
Thank God for instinct, was her first coherent thought. She'd crossed the length of the foyer, snatched Mandy up in her arms, and was patting her comfortingly before any sort of conscious decision to move had been made. "Pants," she said, eyeing the limp form of Rob Cameron. He hadn't twitched since he'd fallen, but she didn't think she'd killed him. She'd have to take more certain steps to neutralize him, and fast.
"Oh, pants. I was just getting ready for bed when this naughty man showed up."
"Oh."
Mandy leaned out of her arms, peering at Cameron.
"Is Mr. Rob? Is a burglar? Is a bad man?"
"Yes, both," Brianna said, deliberately casual. Mandy's speech showed the sibilance it had when she got excited or upset. But the little girl seemed to be recovering pretty fast from the shock of seeing her mother crown a burglar in the front hall, while wearing only a T-shirt and underpants.
The thought made her want to stomp on Cameron's balls, but she choked it back. No time for that. Mandy clung to her neck, but Brianna set her firmly on the stairs.
Mummy wants you to stay here, Agrai.
I have to put Mr. Rob someplace safe, where he can't do anything bad.
No,
Mandy cried, seeing her mother head toward the crumpled Cameron. But Brianna waved in what she hoped was a reassuring manner, picked up the cricket bat as insurance, and nudged her prisoner in the ribs with a cautious toe. He wobbled, but didn't stir. Just in case, she moved round behind him and prodded him rudely between the buttocks with the cricket bat, which made Mandy giggle. He didn't move, and she drew a breath for the first time in what seemed like hours. Going back to the stairs, she gave Mandy the bat to hold and smiled at her. She pushed a strand of sweaty hair behind her ear.
Okay, we're going to put Mr. Rob in the priest's hole. You go and open the door for Mummy, all right?
I hit him,
Mandy asked hopefully, clutching the bat.
No, I don't think you need to do that, darling. Just open the door.
Her work tote was hanging from the coat rack, the big roll of duct tape easily to hand. She trussed Cameron's ankles and wrists, a dozen turns each, then bent, and, clutching him by the ankles, dragged him toward the swinging baize door at the far end of the hall, which separated the kitchen from the rest of the house. He began to stir as they negotiated the big table in the kitchen, and she dropped his feet. Mandy, she said, keeping her voice as calm as possible, I need to have a grown-up talk with Mr. Rob. Give me the bat. Then you go right on out to the mudroom and wait for me there, okay?
Mummy.
Mandy was shrinking back against the sink cabinet, eyes huge and fixed on the moaning Cameron.
Go, Mandy. Right now. Mummy will be there before you can count to 100. Start counting now. 1, 2, 3...
She moved between Cameron and Mandy, motioning firmly with her free hand. Reluctantly, Mandy moved, murmuring,
4, 5, 6, 7,
and disappeared through the back kitchen door. The kitchen was warm from the aga, and despite her lack of clothes, Bree was still streaming with sweat. She could smell herself, feral and acrid, and found that it made her feel stronger. She wasn't sure she'd ever truly understood the term bloodthirsty before, but she did now. "Where's my son?" she said to Cameron, keeping a wary distance in case he tried to roll at her.
"Answer me, you piece of crap, or I'll beat the shit out of you and then call the police." "Yeah."
He rolled slowly onto his side, groaning.
"And tell them what exactly? That I took your boy. What proof of that do you have?"
His words were slurred. His lip was puffed out on one side, where she'd kicked him.
"Fine," she snapped. "I'll just beat the shit out of you." "What? Beat a helpless man? Fine example for your wee lassie."
He rolled onto his back with a muffled grunt. "As for the police, I can tell them you broke into my house and assaulted me." She pointed one foot at him so he could see the livid scratches on her leg. "You'll have my skin cells under your fingernails. And while I'd rather not have Mandy go through it all again, she'd certainly tell them what you were saying in the hallway."
"She would too," Bree thought.
Mandy was a very faithful tape recorder, especially where bad language was concerned. Cameron had closed his eyes, grimacing against the light over the sink, but now opened them again. He was less dazed. She could see the light of calculation back in his eyes. Like most men, she thought, he was probably smarter when he wasn't sexually aroused. And she'd taken care of that.
"Aye. And I'll tell them it was just a wee sex game that got out of hand, and you say it wasn't, and they say, 'Aye, fine, missus, and where's your husband, then?'"
The undamaged side of his mouth twisted up.
"You're not that swift tonight, Hen. But then, you're not usually."
His mention of Roger made the blood surge in her ears. She didn't reply, but grabbed him by the feet and pulled him roughly through the kitchen and into the back passageway. The grating that covered the priest's hole was hidden by a bench and several boxes of milk bottles, bits of farm equipment awaiting repair, and other items that didn't go anywhere else. She dropped Rob's feet, shoved the bench and boxes aside, and pulled up the grating. There was a ladder leaning down into the shadowy space. She pulled this up and slid it behind the bench. That little amenity wouldn't be needed.
Hey!
Rob's eyes widened. Either he hadn't known there really was a priest's hole in the house, or he hadn't thought she'd do it. Without a word, she seized him under the arms, dragged him to the hole, and shoved him in. Feet first, because if he broke his neck, he couldn't tell her where Jem was. He fell with a shriek that was cut short by a heavy thump. Before she could worry that he'd managed to land on his head after all, she heard him moaning and a rustle as he started to stir. A muttering of very bad language further reassured her that he was in good enough shape to answer questions. She fetched the big flashlight from the kitchen drawer and shone it down into the hall. Cameron's face, congested and streaked with blood, glared up at her. He curled up and with some difficulty managed to wiggle into a sitting position.
"You've broken my leg, you fucking bitch."
"Good," she said coldly, though she doubted it. "Once I get Jem back, I'll take you to a doctor." He breathed heavily through his nose, making a nasty snuffling noise, and swiped at his face with his bound hands, smearing the blood across one cheek.
"You want him back? You get me out of here, and fast."
She'd been considering and discarding different plans of action, shuffling through them like a mental pack of cards, ever since she'd duct-taped him. And letting him out wasn't one she'd considered. She had thought of fetching the .22-caliber rifle the family used to hunt rats, and winging him in a few non-essential places. But there was some risk of either disabling him too badly to be of help, or killing him accidentally by hitting something vital if he squirmed.
"Think fast," he shouted up at her. "Your wee lass will hit 100 and be back any second."
Despite the situation, Brianna smiled. Mandy had very recently been introduced to the idea that numbers were infinite and had been enchanted by the concept. She wouldn't stop counting until she ran out of breath or someone stopped her. Still, she wasn't going to engage in pointless conversation with her prisoner.
"Okay," she said,
and reached for the grate. "We'll see how talkative you are after 24 hours without food or water, shall we?"
"You bloody bitch!"
He tried to surge to his feet, but fell over onto his side, writhing impotently.
You just think about this, If I'm without food and water, so's your wee lad."
She froze, the metal edge of the grate digging into her fingers. "Rob, you're not bright," she said. She was amazed that her voice sounded conversational. Waves of horror and relief and renewed horror were rippling across her shoulders, and something primitive in the back of her mind was screaming. A sullen silence from below as he tried to work out what he'd just given away. "Now, I know you didn't send Jem back through the stones," she clarified for him. She carefully didn't shriek,
"But you sent Roger back to look for him,
and he'll never find him. You... "He's still here, in this time." Another silence.
"Yeah," he said slowly. "Okay, you know that. But you don't know where he is. And you're not going to until you turn me loose." "I meant to, Hen. He'll be thirsty by now, and hungry. It'll be a lot worse for him by morning."
Her hand tightened on the grate.
"You had better be lying," she said evenly. "For your sake."
She shoved the grate back into place and stepped on it, clicking it down into its frame. The priest's hole was literally a hole. A space about 6 feet by 8 and 12 feet deep. Even if Rob Cameron hadn't been bound hand and foot, he couldn't jump high enough to get hold of the grate, let alone reach the latch that held it down. Ignoring the furious shouts from below, Brianna went to retrieve her daughter and her jeans. The mudroom was empty, and for an instant she panicked. But then she saw the tiny bare foot sticking out from under the bench, long toes relaxed as a frog's, and her heart rate dropped. A little. Mandy was curled up under Roger's old Mac, thumb half in her mouth, sound asleep. The impulse was to carry her to her bed, let her sleep till daylight. Brianna laid a soft hand on her daughter's black curly hair, black as Roger's, and her heart squeezed like a lemon. There was another child to consider. "Wake up, sweetheart," she said, gently shaking the little girl. "Wake up, honey. We need to go and look for Jem." It took no little cajoling and the administration of a glass of Coca-Cola, a rare treat, and absolutely unheard of so late at night, how exciting, to get Mandy into a state of alertness. But once there, she was all eagerness to go and hunt for her brother. "Mandy," Bree said as casually as she could, buttoning her daughter's pink quilted coat, "can you feel Jem, right now?"
"Ah,"
Mandy replied offhandedly, and Brianna's heart leapt. Two nights before, the child had waked screaming from a sound sleep, weeping hysterically, and insisting that Jem was gone. She had been inconsolable, wailing that her brother had been eaten by big rocks, an assertion that had terrified her parents, who knew the horrors of those particular rocks all too well. But then, a few minutes later, Mandy had suddenly calmed. "Jem was there," she said. "He was there, in her head." And she'd gone back to sleep as though nothing had happened. In the consternation that had followed this episode, the discovery that Jem had been taken by Rob Cameron, one of Brianna's fellow employees at the hydroelectric plant, and presumably taken through the stones into the past, there had been no time to recall Mandy's remark about Jem being back in her head, let alone to make further inquiries. But now Brianna's mind was moving at the speed of light, bounding from one horrifying realization to the next, making connections that might have taken hours to make in cooler blood. Horrifying realization number one. Jem hadn't gone into the past after all. While by itself this was undeniably a good thing, it made horrifying realization number two that much worse. Roger and William Buckley had undoubtedly gone through the stones, searching for Jemmy. She hoped they were, in fact, in the past, and not dead. Travelling through whatever sort of thing the stones were was a bloody dangerous proposition. But if so, that brought her back to horrifying realization number one. Jem wasn't in the past, and if he wasn't there, Roger wasn't going to find him. And since Roger would never give up looking... She pushed horrifying realization number three aside with great force, and Mandy blinked, startled.
"Why are you making faces, Mummy?"
"Practicing for Halloween." She rose, smiling as best she could, and reached for her own duffel coat. Mandy's brow creased in thought.
"When's Halloween?"
Cold rippled over Brianna, and not just from the draught through the crack under the back door. Did they make it? They thought the portal was most active on the sun feasts and fire feasts, and Samhain was an important fire feast. But they couldn't wait the extra day for fear that Jem would be taken too far from Craig na Dún after passing through the stones. "Tomorrow," he said. Her fingers slipped and fumbled on the fastenings, shaky with adrenaline.
"Goody, goody, goody,"
Mandy said, hopping to and fro like a cricket.
"Can I wear my mask to look for Jemmy?"